I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection for the Oregon State Legislature to order. It's Friday, May 25th. We've got a few things to do today. And I'm going to start out by opening up a public hearing on Senate Bill 684A. And up first, I have Senator Rick Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've asked Mr. David Attia to join me. And I know we're going to have to spend a lot of time on 965, which I will talk with you about either, too. But I would appreciate at least this opportunity to address, and then if we get back to the bill later today, we'll do that. And I appreciate the indulgence of the chair and the committee. I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. When I began serving in the Senate, David Attia, who is sitting with me from the Attia Brothers Rug Company, brought to my attention a rug store in Portland had been going out of business for several months. The store claimed to be liquidating everything, but was still bringing in new merchandise. Today, that rug store is still going out of business. These unscrupulous sales mislead consumers and unfairly disadvantage competitive businesses, endless sales that go on for months, discounts, underprices at all their competitor stores, deceptive pricing and false deals, constant replenishment of stock. I want to express my support for Senate Bill 684 and the Dash A7 amendments, which essentially replaced the bill before you. I'll tell you just briefly what that does, and then ask Mr. Tia to give his comments, and again, appreciate this opportunity. In the Senate, we have strong support in the Senate for Senate Bill 684. There was one issue that came up that was actually brought up by Senator Morris, and it was a very good issue. They were concerned about what would be essentially a $50 fee for a permit to go out of business. And it just didn't sound right, you know, for the people who aren't doing the sham sales, you know, to have to pay a $50 fee to go out of business. I said, I agree with that. It wasn't the idea of having to pay a fee. The whole idea was a permit, which comes from other states' languages. 25 other states have this type of protection for consumers and businesses. The reason for the permit was not to gain money. The reason for the permit was to have an official start date so that all the issues in the bill could be measured against that start date for the requirements of the legislation. So working with the Department of Justice and the Secretary of State, we have eliminated from the bill in the Dash A7 amendment, and now it simply requires that a business that is going to advertise that they're going out of business simply has to notify the Secretary of State that they're going to conduct a going out of business sale. And so they'll have a registered date to apply the provisions of the bill, so there's no longer a fee, quote, to go out of business. I wanted to put that on and really appreciated Senator Morris's help on that. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to go to Mr. David Attia, who will tell you the reason behind the bill, and again, thank you very much for having us up here.
Thank you. Mr. Attia, if you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
My name is David Attia, president of Attia Brothers Rug and Carpet Company. I've submitted written copies of my testimony, if those are available or distributed. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Senator Metzger, for your introduction, and good afternoon. I support Senate Bill 684, which provides benefits for the public and establishes clear regulations for businesses which are closing operations. With my business partner, Thomas Marantette, we are the third-generation owners of Attia Brothers Rugs and Carpeting, founded in 1900 by my grandfather and his brother in downtown Portland. Our business remains entirely based in Oregon, with operating locations in Multnomah, Washington, and Lane counties. As a privately owned business, we enjoy the spirit of competition against similar-sized and much larger companies, which creates incentives to improve customer service and merchandise selections. We are certainly not afraid of fair competition, as proved by 107 years in business. Our company's longevity has been built upon ethical and honest business practices. For this reason, we have consistently supported efforts of the Oregon Department of Justice to implement with the Oregon Legislature basic regulations for going out of business, which I'll refer by the letters GOB, type retail sales. In support of Senate Bill 684 and in other correspondence, the Justice Department has cited the specific reasons that these regulations are necessary to protect the public interest for phony going out of business, liquidation, and other misleading sales relating to closure of a business exist. We understand at least 25 other states have similar regulations, including, for over a decade, our neighbor, Washington State. I am not aware that such limited state regulations in Washington and other states have in any way restricted the legitimate interests of business to close their operations and liquidate assets when necessary. In Oregon, the lack of any regulation over GOB-type retail sales has led to tax avoidance and widespread consumer fraud, including dishonesty in advertising, pricing abuses, misleading marketing, and fabricated information directed to the unsuspecting consumer. This is supported by dozens of complaints from the public to the Civil Enforcement Division at the State Department of Justice, as well as the personal experiences reported within the past 2 weeks by State Senator Margaret Carter. Let me share three examples within our floor covering industry, although these problems are just as prevalent in many other lines of business. First, merchandise fraud. When the U.S. Customs trade embargo with Iran was in place over a 20-year period, phony going-out-of-business sales in Oregon served as a pipeline to introduce illegal Iranian rugs smuggled from Canada. Our company reported these abuses to both U.S. Customs and the State Justice Department, which did not have the enforcement tools now recommended in Senate Bill 684. Unregulated GOB sales and liquidation sales continue to be a dumping ground for poor quality merchandise sold to Oregon consumers through deception. Second, false marketing. In year 2000, a major rug store closing occurred in downtown Portland. Based on our personal observations, hundreds of additional rugs were regularly added to this store's inventory during several months of sale. After the sale's completion, we counted over 150 bales of consigned or non-owned rugs being returned to New York and New Jersey rug supplier importers. Within 6 months of this closure, the same store owner opened another Oriental rug business 1 mile away from the original location and later conducted a months-long closing event which was investigated by the Department of Justice. They were unable to act due to the lack of specific regulations like those now incorporated in Senate Bill 684. Third, unlimited or indefinite GOB sale dates. When our showroom moved from downtown Portland in 2001, a nearby Oriental Rug store location was conducting a liquidation sale. 6 years later, a rug sale is still in progress at this location, but is now advertised as a GOB sale. Senate Bill 684 is effective for all imminent business closures, regardless of their terminology. In January of this year, we brought to the attention of the Justice Department two other GOB sales with no ending dates. Only after contact from the Justice Department did these businesses state an ending date. In early May, one advertisement said, 2 days left, and doors closing forever. The very next weekend, this company advertised it had gone out of business, but thousands of Oriental rugs would be included in a huge 3-day auction event, May 12th to the 14th. Last weekend, the sale was still continuing, and the owner has publicly stated store closure may be, quote, sometime in June. As a past vice chairman of the Portland Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce and as a member of several Portland business and civic organizations, I have received numerous calls and personal contacts in support of Senate Bill 684. Attached are exhibit letters from two companies, one in business for 136 years, George & Son Cutlery, and the other 81 years, Denehanians, who closed upon retirement in an ethical and timely manner. The owners both support Senate Bill 684. Members of our company belong to several Rotary Clubs, which are present in 112 of your Oregon communities. Rotary Standards ask, is it the truth? And is it fair to all concerned? Every Oregon business should support the same ethical standards in their relations with the public. Oregon has ignored the problem of false and misleading GOB-type retail sales for too long. Senate Bill 684 does not place restrictions or burdens on legitimate business closing activities. I ask each of you to approve the specific enforcement tools needed by the State Department of Justice and pass Senate Bill 684, a pro-consumer and pro-good business legislation. These limited GOB regulations will provide clear and consistent standards for business marketing practices and would protect Oregon retail consumers from frequent misleading trade practices. Thank you for your interest.
Thank you, Mr. Tia, for bringing this forward, and you, Senator Metzger, for bringing this problem forward, and I believe Oregon won't ignore this much longer. So,
thank you.
Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And when you do get back to the bill, you'll note that the Department of Justice is supporting, and when that time comes, you'd like to hear from them. They'll be happy to comment. Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you. And with that, I'd like to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 684 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 965. Could I have Senator Margaret Carter, please?
Are you going to give us an overview?
Steve, would you give us a quick overview of this bill?
Thank you, Chair Holby. Senate Bill 965 requires lenders involved in residential property non-traditional mortgage products to ensure loan terms and underwriting standards for products and consider a borrower's repayment capacity and risk mitigation factors.
Thank you. Senator Carter.
Thank you.
What a pleasure having you here.
Thank you, Chair Holby and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to come before your committee today, and I appreciate very much you allowing me to come early so I can get back to other duties very much. I do know that Senator Gordley is going to come down and
she's here.
Anyway, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Margaret Carter. I serve as State Senator from District 22, North Northeast Portland. Many of you who know North Northeast Portland know that District 22 is one of the hottest areas in the real estate market. I'm a living testimony to that. I have properties in that real estate market, and contrary to maybe some people belief, I believe in market share, and I believe in the American way of doing business to a great extent, but not to the extent for which I'm testifying against today. At the same time that we live in a very, very hot real estate market, the community has substantial needs for affordable, accessible housing for needy, lower, and middle-income and fixed-income households. We need to protect consumers in mortgage lending, is my message to you today. We need to protect the vulnerable and not allow those that might pray or take advantage of others to do so. In Oregon and across the nation, African Americans are substantially more likely than other racial groups to refinance and purchase homes through subprime lenders. Over the decade from 1993 to 2002, subprime lenders originated 29.4%, almost one-third of the refinanced loans taken out by African Americans in Oregon. The rate is 3.5 times the rate for white borrowers. The majority of mortgage loans to African Americans are subprime loans. For most types of subprime home loans, even after controlling for legitimate risk factors, are at greater risk of receiving higher rate loans than their white counterparts. I'm here to ask you to end economic discriminatory practices and to work against these outcomes in the marketplace. Race and ethnicity should not be a factor to the outcome and the product accessibility on the price of subprime mortgages. Discrimination and practices that have outcomes that discriminate should have no place in Oregon, not Oregon today or the Oregon we want to see. I am very much in support of Senate Bill 965 as it stands, and I encourage you to make this an even better bill. Mr. Chairman, we have, and we will be submitting to you and for some that was left over, the effect of race and ethnicity on the price of subprime mortgages, unfair lending. This piece was done by Debbie Grunstein Bashian, I think. I hope that I'm not murdering her name. Keith S. Ernst and Wei Lee, Center for Responsible Lending. And the things that they found in their study that show that for most types of subprime home loans, African-American and Latino borrowers are at greater risk of receiving higher rate loans than white borrowers, even after controlling for legitimate risk factors. So nobody is asking people to eat the risk. We are saying be reasonable and non-discriminatory. They further said that African Americans were more likely to receive higher rate home purchase and refinance loans than similarly situated white borrowers, particularly for loans with prepayment penalties. The second thing they said, the effect of being an African American borrower on the cost of credit was greatest for loans containing penalties for early payoff, which comprised over 60% of the loans that these researchers examined. And they, you will see in our information that we gave you that African-American borrowers with prepayment penalties on their subprime home loans were 6 to 34% more likely to receive a higher rate loan than if they had been white borrowers with similar qualifications. And it goes on and on, but you can please read for your own intelligence in terms of what you do with this bill. But I would certainly hope, Mr. Chairman, that you will pass this bill as you have before you now. And thank you very much, because the technical people will be coming on after me, as you know. A whole room full.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Carter, for bringing this legislation forward, and the intent of your legislation. We are going to endeavor to get through a barrage of amendments and make sure your intent stays intact.
Thank you.
Senator Metzger, did you wish to testify on this bill?
Chair, I think I would like to testify later in the hearing.
Okay, well, the public hearing on 965 will be much later. We got a few other bills we need to go through. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 965.
Excuse me. Wait a minute.
We're going to rehear it.
You just said close it.
It's just a procedure.
Okay, I apologize.
Don't panic.
Okay. I'm learning a lot.
It doesn't help your clothes.
Yeah.
That's what I'm doing next. With that, I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 431 if there's nobody objects. Oh, excuse me. I'm going to close that public hearing on Senate Bill 431. I object. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 431A. And Senator Gordley and anybody you'd like to accompany you. Yes. Steve, would you give us a brief review of where we're at with Senate Bill 431?
Thank you, Chair Holby. Senate Bill 431 prohibits a landlord from having a motor vehicle removed from the premises without notice to a tenant who owns or operates the vehicle except under specified circumstances. And I believe it's the dash A7s that are in front of the committee right now, which is
a 7 or 6?
A7s, which were...
I got 6s, 3s, and 5s.
Oh, I've got 6s, 7s.
I got 6s.
Okay. A7s, do you have a copy of the present?
Yeah, I just have 6.
Mike's bringing you. And thank you.
Thank you. Senator Gordley, it's nice to have you back.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. For the record, I am Abel Gordley, representing Senate District 23 in Multnomah County. And I'm here just to briefly thank the committee again for hearing the bill, for asking such good questions for the record, establishing why this is good public policy. You do have an amendment before you, and Sybil Hebb and others are here to help clarify the intent of the amendment. But again, I just appreciate so much the intent of the chair to move the bill today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Chair Gordley, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, in support of the Dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 431. First of all, just want to really thank, express my appreciation for Senator Gordley's work and leadership on this issue, and for the leadership of Sean Cruz, who have both contributed so much time and effort to this issue. I want to just briefly summarize what the A7 amendments do, just to refresh your memory from our discussion at the last week's hearing. I'll just let you know what the A7s do, and then I can just briefly identify how they're different from what we talked about previously. Senate Bill 431A with the A7 amendments is going to protect towing abuses within the landlord-tenant relationship in rental housing. This bill deals only with the relationship between landlords and tenants, and it does not deal with other regulation of the towing industry, which was addressed by Senate Bill 116, which this committee heard a couple of weeks ago and voted in favor of. So this bill will provide that a landlord may only tow a car without notice to the tenant if it's improperly parked in one of four circumstances. Five. And so the circumstances in which a car may be towed without notice to the tenant are if it is blocking an access to emergency vehicles, if it is blocking an entry or an exit, if it's parked in an area that is prominently marked no parking, or if it's in a space that's reserved for a person with disabilities and it's improperly parked there, or if it's in an area that is not intended for motor vehicles, and by that we mean landscaping, lawns, sidewalks, that sort of thing. The other circumstance in which a car can be towed without notice to a tenant is if it is parked in a space that's reserved for tenants, that is not guest parking, that's just tenant parking, and it doesn't have an agreed-upon sticker or tag that is required by a written agreement between the landlord and the tenant, and that the stickers are provided to the tenants and made available by the landlords, and all of the details about that are written in the agreement. And also, the agreement must contain information about the tower, that is, where to contact the tower, what the process is to regain the car, unless that information is prominently posted in the parking lot. The other thing that is new to these amendments that must be specified in the written agreement is whether guest parking is allowed or not. There's some apartment complexes, as we know, that are in the inner city, and there's not any parking space associated with the parking, so some places don't have guest parking available. If that's the case, it needs to be specifically identified for the tenants. And if guest parking is allowed, it needs to be detailed in the agreement how a tenant goes about either figuring out which space is allocated for guests and or finding a tag or a sticker or some way of identifying vehicles that are guest vehicles. So that information needs to be provided to the tenants in these agreements. The other provisions of the bill are that if a landlord assigns a specific space to a tenant, a specific parking space to a tenant, then the landlord may not ever tow the car from that space without the tenant's permission. And I think that gets at some of the questions that Representative Nelson and others were asking about guest parking and tenant-specific spaces. The other, another provision significantly of the A7 bill would be that a tenant's vehicle may not be towed solely because it is inoperable unless the landlord gives 72 hours prior notice to the tenant. And then the last provision is that a landlord may never tow a vehicle solely because it is not properly registered and licensed. So those are that's the full panoply of the protections offered by the bill. The A7 amendments are substantially like the A6 amendments, which I think this committee had in front of it last week, and only add a few sort of rewording and restructuring provisions. One final thing I wanted to mention is that someone had asked a question as to whether or not this bill would preempt any local ordinances, and there is no preemption clause in the bill. So I believe that wraps up the summary. I'm happy to answer any questions or to turn it over.
Chairman Holby and members of the committee, my name is Norton Cabell, and I'm the legislative director of Oregon Rental Housing Association, which represents about 4,500 landlords around the state. And I won't repeat everything that Sybil said, but we, the landlord side, fully support the bill as presented to you. I did want to add one thing. A question came up about the very end of the act where it says this section does not apply to a landlord of a facility. A facility is specifically defined in Chapter 90 Oregon Landlord Tenant Law to mean a manufactured dwelling park or floating home moorage for floating homes. So, in essence, it's mobile home parks and floating home marinas, excuse me, and that's all that this exemption covers.
Thank you.
I no longer have a question.
You no longer have a question. Just for the record, this Senate Bill 431 with the A7 amendments would not preempt any city from towing, you know, based on their nuisance ordinances.
There's no preemption clause in the bill, so there would be no preemption.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you very much, good Senator Gordley, for bringing this bill and for y'all supporting it. Just clarify to me this preempt, because I'm worried that Sean Cruz might get in another problem like this because the city of Portland has some laws and this doesn't preempt it, and we're trying to help him, not kill him.
Well, Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, I'm by no means a statutory expert around preemption, but my understanding is that unless a bill specifically provides preemption, then local governments can make their own rules or regulations. But this law would govern the landlord's relationship with a tenant. It's my understanding that if a city had ordinances that were nuisance ordinances, that would be something that would apply to individuals who have cars who may be in violation of ordinances, but it wouldn't have anything to do with the landlord and tenant relationship. There may be someone else who can offer other perspective about that.
Further questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to further follow up with Vice Chair Nelson. In just said his name.
Sean's
case, it was a landlord relationship that caused his difficulty. Is that correct?
Representative Gilliam, Terholvey, I'm not familiar with all of the facts of that case. I'm not sure I could remember them accurately, so I wouldn't want to speak for him. Sorry.
For the record, my name is Sean Cruz, Senator Gordley's Chief of Staff. I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Mr. Chair.
Very quickly.
In your case that brought this to our attention, my question was, and I think it might have been answered, but was the landlord relationship that we're addressing in this bill part of the problem in your case?
Chair Holby, Representative Gilliam, yes. Though I don't have a landlord. I'm a homeowner, own my own home. I live next door to a property with an absentee landlord. And it was the landlord's relationship with their property manager and their towing company. When they started towing my vehicles, they all pointed their fingers at each other as to who was responsible.
Andy? Oh, sorry.
Are you going to let him have a follow-up?
One follow-up?
It's a good question.
Okay. So how are you feeling good about the Dash 7s as it would relate to your case as well?
Chair Holby, Representative Gilden, yes, I am.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we adopt the Dash 7 amendments to Senate Bill 431.
Representative Bonamici moves we adopt the A7 amendments to Senate Bill 431. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, they're so adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 431 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves Senate Bill 431A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Riley.
Very briefly, I'm going to support this bill. I think it's a good bill. I personally don't think it's going to solve Sean's problem, because I don't think this has anything to do with what happened to Sean. And I believe that we need to, at some point, do some further work in this area.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, I think that was a brilliant statement by Representative Riley, and I agree.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. I think Representative Riley and I have had that discussion before and have agreed that we need further work in towing in this state, not just with landlord-tenant law. With that, Mr. Riley, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Senate Bill 431, having received the required majority votes, is declared moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you, Senator. Would anyone like to volunteer to carry this bill on the floor?
I'd be happy to.
Representative Nelson,
mm-hmm.
You spoke first. It's yours.
Thank you.
I want to make sure we close the work session on Senate Bill 431. With that, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 447. Steve, give us a brief little summary of Senate Bill 447.
Thank you, Chair Holdy. Just a reminder for the committee, Senate Bill 447 adds deceased to the definition of person and trust company account information to the definition of protected identification for the crime of identity theft. So basically you can't steal a dead person's identity. It was brought to us by the Oregon Bankers Association. Tim Martinez testified in favor and no one testified against.
Interesting. Mr. Martinez, would you like to say a few words about this Senate bill? Thank you. We are in a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 447 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves Senate Bill 447 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Does it change the calendar?
No.
No? Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Yes, well, I just want to commend Mr. Martinez for bringing this. I have heard horror stories about situations where individuals are using the deceased's identity, and it makes me ill. So thank you very much, and this is a good bill and should pass.
Thank you. With that, Mr. Riley, will you please call the roll?
Representative
Gilliam? Aye.
Representative
Gerard?
Yeah. Yes, aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Representative
Bonamici? Aye. Representative Nelson? Aye. Senate Bill 447, having received majority votes, is declared moved and passed to the floor.
Oh. Representative Gilliam thought it was
that,
dead.
No.
No.
With that, I'd like to close the work session on Senate Bill 447. Do I have a carrier?
I just volunteer a carrier.
Representative Bonamici will carry Senate Bill 447 on the floor. Okay. With that, I'm going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 965A. We have a silent sheet? Do we have panning the crowd?
David Tapman.
Are you here?
Or which one?
And he is not here.
What are we on?
965.
Here's
I'm glad my voice. I'm glad my voice.
Missed your opportunity.
Glad my voice carries.
I'm not sure if this is one of those opportunities I wanted to miss, but you know, I wouldn't miss this for the world.
Thank you. We just opened a public hearing on Senate Bill 965A, or reopened it.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is David Tatman, and I'm the Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, and I've been before you on a number of occasions this session. Just as a reminder, the Division is part of the Department of Consumer Business Services, and we regulate the vast majority of the financial services in the state of Oregon. And I bring that up because I want to testify today regarding Senate Bill 965 that is codifying guidelines that we had adopted early in January. The fact is that we regulate a number of sections of the financial services industry, including banks, credit unions, consumer finance companies, and mortgage lending companies. And all of them comprise the industries that make mortgage loans in the state of Oregon. And I think it's important to remember that when you hear the word mortgage loan, we're not talking just about mortgage bankers and mortgage brokers. We're talking about a wide array of entities that make these loans. And that really gets to the crux of the matter. Senate Bill 965 in its genesis started out an attempt to address certain types of loans, high-end loans, expensive loans, or loans that were of a more expensive interest rate for people that were, for lack of a better word, subprime borrowers. The decision was made that that particular version did not get to anything that was necessary to be addressed in the state of Oregon because loans were not being made at that high an interest rate. So the question became, what did we want to try and address in 965? By way of background, 965 came about because we've seen such a significant change in the mortgage industry and mortgage lending practices in the country as well as the state of Oregon. I don't want to get into a lot of detail. I'm not an economist, but I think most of you are personally familiar and certainly read the paper or aware how much housing costs have gone up in the last 10 years, how much our economy is driven by construction and by home lending itself. It's a big component within the state of Oregon and within the nation. But I think you're also aware that recently, as the market has cooled off some, we have seen a number of changes and problems in the lending arena. Subprime mortgages in throughout the country, we are seeing a number of situations where defaults and foreclosures are increasing. Oregon has seen a increase in foreclosures and defaults, but we have not seen a dramatic increase. In part, I think that has to do reflecting on that Oregon usually lags the economy by a few years, and so we may be still in a situation where we may come to face that later, or it may be that we never had the spike in house prices that encourages this type of lending. So for whatever reason, we don't see that yet, but we're not convinced that we won't have this come down later on. Anyway, as I said, because of the concerns about this, in January of 2007, our agency adopted guidelines. And these guidelines were promoted by the ARMR and CSBS. Those are two associations that are made up of state agencies that regulate mortgage lenders and banks. And those guidelines were an adoption of federal guidelines that were applied to banks and savings and loans and credit unions. The guidelines were an attempt to try and get to issues of concern in certain non-traditional loans. That's the phrase we're using. Some might call it subprime. Subprime's a broader area, so we're calling them non-traditional loans. When you think of a traditional loan, it would be a 30-year fixed-rate loan. That is a fixed interest rate. The non-traditional loans are something that moves from that direction. Adjustable-rate mortgages, those are fairly traditional, but interest-only loans with adjustable-rate mortgages, that's one of the federal guidelines and our guidelines say is a non-traditional loan. We've seen negative amortization loans, payment option loans where the borrower has the option of paying 100% of the amortized amount per month, or they can pay just a portion of it, or they can pay the interest to stay current on the interest, or they can pay less than even the going rate of the interest, and they end up losing equity in the home because that value is being diminished by the fact they're not making sufficient monthly payments. So based on all that, these guidelines were adopted to try and address how borrowers, excuse me, how lenders should conduct lending practices when making interest-only loans and payment option loans. These were guidelines that, as I said, the feds have adopted, the federal government has adopted, and some 30 states have adopted. As we approach 965, then the decision was made to attempt to incorporate the guidelines into Senate Bill 965. And what you have before you now is Senate Bill 965A. And they follow the guidelines to a great degree. The guidelines use phrases like should, recommend, encourage. The statute, because it's a statute, has to address things with specifics, shall, must, and so forth. So you're going to see a significant difference there. We think that's an important piece. If we're asking people to enforce, if we're being asked to enforce practices, we think we have to have clear instruction that you are required to do something. Not that you're recommended to do a certain practice or that we think that's the best policy. We want to be able to specifically say you do this or you're in violation. Having said that, there are times where that rigidity is a problem. And so we have talked with members of the industry, and it is our position right now that there is a need for some rulemaking to maybe identify areas where rigidity is not the best way to go. I've got copies of the guidelines here that we have adopted in January. I will hand them out. I think they're more just for background. As the bill comes to you in its current form, it's the subject of a number of meetings of a work group that was put together on the Senate side and had consumer advocates, representatives of the lending industries, representatives of our office, as well as representatives of the Senate. And we think this was an attempt to find that middle ground, and we think they did a commendable job. I think you will hear from others testifying that there are variations between the guidance that you have in front of you and the language in the bill, and I would agree there are some variations. Sometimes I think they're just semantical variations. Sometimes they may be variations that need to be further addressed. I think that can be done by rulemaking if people are uncertain of what a term means. At the work session, consumer protection advocates were advocating for specific lending products to be prohibited. The decision of the work group was to go forward without prohibiting any one product. The decision was made that practices should be addressed. Make sure that underwriting standards are appropriate. Make sure that disclosure is full and complete to borrowers. Make sure that borrowers' representations have been documented to some degree. In other words, that we want good, prudent lending practices used, not come in and tell people what loans and what products they should or shouldn't use. And so the decision was made to go with these guidance rather than go with prohibitions of certain practices. To make sure that the guidance were applied across the board, though, we consistently said we wanted to see that all lenders in the state of Oregon be treated equally, level playing field. So we want to make sure that banks, credit unions, consumer finance companies, mortgage lenders, and mortgage brokers all are subject to the application of this particular bill. And that's the way it currently reads right now. In addition to that, we want to make sure the bill is workable. And we've had a number of people come to us. I will say this has been one busy week for us addressing 965 from the industry's perspective. And a number of people have expressed specific concerns and then just some general concerns. And I suspect you've probably heard some of those yourself. We've tried to focus on the specific concerns. And there were three, and we have sent amendment-type language forward to address a couple of them, and I don't know what the status is on those, so I will just give you the concept, and I assume you've got more amendments than you probably can keep track of at this moment, but conceptually the two amendments we addressed were as follows. The There was a grave concern about the phrase interest-only loan. And the interest-only loan is defined in the guidelines, both federal and state, as a non-traditional loan. And we are told that interest-only loans are routinely used in a number of circumstances, particularly in construction loans and in secondary loans, if you will, home equity lines of credit or HELOCs. And there's a concern that this makes it sound like those products are considered bad products or should be held to the highest scrutiny. We think that it would be, and we've proposed an amendment format, that we should be allowed, or we should, the agency should be given authority to attempt to define interest-only loans when they should be subject to these guidelines, so that we could work with the industry and make sure that we are not precluding certain practices that are routine and were not intended to be subject to 965. And as I mentioned, that would probably be in the area of home equity loans, which the federal guidelines actually do say they don't intend to apply, and construction loans. Another area in which we've introduced an amendment based on our conversations with industry is in the area of mortgage brokers. The bill talks about limiting banks' credit or inclusion of banks, credit unions, consumer finance, and mortgage bankers. Mortgage brokers, though, the ones that originate the loans, the ones who deal with the public on a day-to-day basis, are not in the bill. The mortgage brokers have asked to be included in the bill, held to the same standard. We support that, and so we've proposed or gone forward with that particular amendment. Again, I apologize, I don't know the number. There's a third area, and one that I think is worthy of note, and that is this area of automated underwriting systems. And I think you'll probably hear testimony about that. Some call it desk underwriting. But what it is, it's a computerized process by which all the information that the loan originator takes from the consumer is then reduced down into numerical information and sent to a computer, and the computer processes this and determines if somebody qualifies for the loan. In other words, the computer does the underwriting. Now, the underwriters themselves, or the loan originators, have to make a preliminary decision, is this particular product an appropriate product for this borrower. And so they do some initial screening, but ultimately they're telling us that this automatic system makes a determination if somebody is an appropriate candidate for a loan. And they feel like the bill as it's currently drafted shifts the burden away from what is going on in fact and puts the burden back on the originators and lenders to make a determination if that's an appropriate loan. And because of the private right of action within the bill, their concern is that they're going to be liable for decisions that they ultimately don't get to make. They have to rely on this underwriting process that is used through the computer process. This is a long-standing practice. We're told this has been around for numerous years, more than 10 years. The federal government actually, through Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the two government agencies will review these underwriting standards being done automatically or through computers, and they essentially give some form of approval. Most of us feel like if the federal government said this is appropriate, the underwriting standards are being met, we think it's probably appropriate that we would allow that as an alternative form of deciding when a particular loan is appropriate for a particular borrower. Therefore, we would probably come back to the committee, depending on the direction the committee takes, and suggest an amendment that would allow us to define circumstances using automatic underwriting systems as an alternative to the standards, particularly in subsection 4 of the bill. We have taken a position that we are comfortable with this bill. We think the bill achieves some laudable goals. It helps protect homeowners and borrowers, but it also gives some guidance for the lenders out there. In addition, we think it's important that we get this right. Now, we understand that there is an alternative bill that may be introduced, or at least an amendment to the bill, that essentially would give the agency authority to adopt the guidelines by rule and essentially scrub this bill out. I have seen a version of it. That version, as it was drafted, is not acceptable, but we understand that there are potential amendments to that version. Our concern would be, one, any guidance that we are given or authority to adopt guidelines would cover all the forms of lenders in the state of Oregon. As I said, banks, credit unions, consumer finance companies, and mortgage bankers and brokers. Secondly, we'd like to be clear that if we adopt guidelines, that those guidelines are, again, prescribing behavior or describing the behavior that has to be taken place. If it's all in the conjecture of could, may, I don't know if that gets us to the point where we can effectively enforce it. And third, we think it's appropriate that there is a consistent pattern of enforcement attached to any charge that we're giving. We want to make sure that if a mortgage lender violates a practice, regardless of whether it's a bank or a consumer finance company or a mortgage broker, that the penalties that they could receive are consistent across the board. So if should that second version or second proposal come up, we're prepared to work towards that and would see that if those parameters or sideboards are there, we could probably live with those also.
Thank you, Mr. Tatman. I appreciate your testimony. I think you've given us a really good overview. I would ask that if possible, you try to let us know what amendment versions that you've had an opportunity to look at, because a lot of the amendments that evidently that are out there have not been made available to this chair yet. And so it would be kind of important for me to know what's going on in the amendments. And in light of that, I also want to make sure that you're available on Wednesday to come back to this committee, and because I want to get a lot of testimony in here at this point.
Okay.
And we're going to probably walk through a few of the different amendments that are out there, or listen to people's concerns out here, and hopefully, if you're not available to make note of those, my committee administrator will be making notes of concerns so that we can follow up with you at a later date. And I'm going to suspend questions of Mr. Tatman from the committee at this point, because he will be back if the committee will indulge me in writing down their questions to come back on Wednesday for Mr. Tatman. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can we ask our good committee administrator what passed the Senate? You gave us the data. We don't know if it's the amended version of the bill, because the first one's got edited stuff. I'd just like to know what we're talking about from now on.
The bill in its current form is 965A.
Okay, thank you.
And there are numerous amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Tatman. And yes. Representative Kotek, did you wish to testify? And I would like to also bring up Jonas Monist and Angela Martin to come up with Representative Kotek, please. And if you know, not to be rude to my colleagues, but if you do have written testimony, if you could summarize it for us, because we do have a lot of people that have traveled that would like to have a few words to say, I would appreciate that.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, Chair Holby, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. I will be brief. I am proposing the Dash 11 amendments, which I believe you all have a copy of, that would put some sideboards on prepayment penalties. One of the problems in the subprime mortgage market is, an excessive use of the prepayment penalties. Oregon has a particular problem with how we do this. Compared to the prime loan market in Oregon, about 11% of loans have prepayment penalties. In the subprime market, that number is 92%. And so what you'll see in the Dash 11s is there's some definitions, and then there's a trigger mechanism talking about loans over a certain interest rate, 6%, and when prepayment penalties would not be allowed. So I urge your support of that amendment, and be happy to come back next week and answer more questions, but I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And whoever wants to go next, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jonas Monas. I'm with the Center for Responsible Lending, which is based in Durham, North Carolina. We're a nonprofit, nonpartisan research and policy organization dedicated to protecting home ownership and family wealth by promoting responsible lending practices and access to fair terms of credit for low-wealth families. We're also an affiliate of Self Help, which is one of the nation's largest community development lenders. Self Help actually makes subprime loans. We've been in the business of making loans to people with less than perfect credit since 1985, when that practice was actually unusual in the industry. We draw on Self-Help's experience as a lender in advocating common sense approaches to market failures and lender abuses that harm homeowners, and also to those who want to be homeowners in the pursuit of security and opportunity. I just want to lay a little bit of groundwork why this is important. Home equity is the single largest savings account that most people will ever have. This equity is used by families to send children to college, start new businesses, or weather crises such as job loss or extended illness. Nearly 60% of total wealth held by middle-class families resides in their home equity, which is the value of their home minus the amount they owe on it. And obviously for a lower-income family, that percentage would be quite a bit higher. Nationally, we're seeing a foreclosure crisis. We estimate, my organization estimates, that 1 in 5 subprime loans made in the past 2 years are expected to end in foreclosure. We've actually been told by industry analysts, particularly Lehman Brothers, that our estimate is conservative. They expect it to be approximately 30%. There are reasons for this. The characteristics of the majority of subprime loans today, they're loose underwriting standards. There's what called a no-doc loan, where income verification is not required. Somebody can just come in and tell a broker or a mortgage lender how much they make, what their monthly income is, and there's no attempt to verify that. It's also, underwriting standards don't necessarily consider whether somebody can afford to repay a loan that's going to have an adjustable rate mortgage when that mortgage jumps, when it resets. There's equity stripping through high fees, both at the front end, to fees paid to brokers. There's also fees at the back end, prepayment penalty fees. Anytime that a homeowner pays a high fee like that, it's stripping equity out of the home. There's also lack of accountability for loan originators. States have always been at the forefront of protecting borrowers from predatory mortgage lending. The first wave of state laws regarding predatory mortgage lending focused on equity stripping. The next wave of state laws are addressing loose underwriting standards used to qualify borrowers for high-risk products. The most common product that we see in the market today, and we believe one of the most abusive, is called a 228. It's a loan that has an artificially low teaser rate for the first 2 years, so the payment is going to be quite low for the first 2 years. At the end of the two-year period, the rate is going to jump, and it's going to reset every 6 months based on either LIBOR or a T-note, some index that's out there. Often the underwriting is done based on the first 2 years, that low payment, so families they may not even know that the reset is taking place, but the reset could require up to a 40% jump in the monthly mortgage payment. And for a lot of families that are struggling to get by, that's just too much. If they have equity left in their home, they can refinance. If they have already refinanced to the point where they owe more than their home is worth, then it often ends in foreclosure. In our opinion, any underwriting standard should look at the ability, a borrower's ability to repay at the fully indexed rate, and it should also include an escrow account for taxes and insurance. Escrow accounts are not common in the subprime market, whereas the majority of prime loans actually have escrow accounts. Minnesota, Colorado, Ohio, these states have already passed these new underwriting standards. It's under consideration in other states. And just to be clear, these laws in other states actually go farther than the laws than Senate Bill 965 and the amendments that I'll actually explain in a moment. So again, Senate Bill 965, that what we consider to be the primary protection there is that there's an underwriting standard, the ability to repay. There's also an amendment before you that would prohibit loan flipping. Flipping is the practice of inducing a borrower to enter into a new home loan to refinance when there's no actual net benefit to the borrower. The only reason that they're being induced to do so is to create more fees going to the brokers or the lenders. That standard's already in place in North Carolina, New Mexico, Ohio, Illinois, and Massachusetts, just to name a few states. And there will also be the amendment that was just described to you minutes ago, prohibits prepayment penalties after 1 year. And just to be clear, that's actually a compromise position. It recognizes that there are costs that go into making a home loan, and if somebody refinances out of a home loan within a year, then the lender may not have recouped their costs. So allowing a lender to charge a prepayment penalty if somebody refinances within 1 year, we consider to be a reasonable compromise. And finally, my last point, these protections do not limit access to credit. We know that. CRL did a study that was released last year where we looked at the states with the strongest protections. We compared it to access to credit in states that have little or no protections in the mortgage market. What we found was there was really no discernible difference in APR and fees, that sort of thing. In a couple of states, it was actually a slightly lower average APR. And this has been confirmed by industry analysts. 85% of lenders making subprime loans in Oregon are already complying with prepayment penalty and loan flipping restrictions in North Carolina. 83% of subprime lenders in Oregon already operate in New Mexico, where there are similar provisions. The sky will not fall if you pass if you pass 965 with the loan flipping and prepayment penalty provisions. Most lenders already comply with those standards anyway. With that, I will stop, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We're going to suspend with questions for right now. Ms. Martin, do you have some short testimony you'd like to give?
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Members of the committee, my name is Angela Martin. I'm here representing Our Oregon. I'm here testifying today in support of Senate Bill 965 and in support of the Dash 11 and Dash 7 amendments. I will keep my comments brief. I'll start by explaining that I live in the same district that Senator Carter lives in. And last week, while I was thinking about what comments I was going to make to the National Association of Real Estate Brokers before their policymaking conference, I was invited as a panelist to talk about subprime lending. I took a walk through my neighborhood because I knew there was a sign in my neighborhood that would remind me that I live in what was formerly the Red Line District. In my community, it used to be a limited access to credit that was holding families back. And that morning, I was going to be going to making presentation to a panel of real estate agents who were there to talk about the fact that an overextension of credit and inappropriate credit products was the problem that neighborhoods like mine were now facing. When we heard testimony on the Senate side, we were joined by a woman who works in the building and explained that her mother took out a loan. She also lives in my neighborhood. She took out a loan against her house after she got sick and saw rising health care costs that she could not afford. She didn't know what she was getting into and was desperate. The house that she had lived in for 37 years, the house she had paid off, was her only source of wealth that she was able to tap into to pay those medical expenses. So as is in public record in the testimony, she refinanced into a loan that was a subprime loan and ended up consuming 75% of the equity in her house through that refinance. She got so close to foreclosure that she finally went to her daughters and explained the trouble that she was in. And her daughters quickly had to assess the situation to help save the home, not only that their mother lives in, but the home that they grew up in. This is a story that's played out over and over again in communities across Oregon. Let me give you some Oregon-specific numbers. These do come from Center for Responsible Lending Statistics, but they give the picture of what's happening, what we're facing in our state. Of people who took out subprime loans last year, in the Portland metropolitan area, 20% of those homeowners are at risk for foreclosure. In the Salem area, we're looking at 18.5% of subprime borrowers are at risk of foreclosure. Medford, 19.2%. Eugene, 18.8%. This is no small figure. What this figure doesn't tell you are the number of borrowers who may be able to hold off foreclosure by handing over significant amounts of their equity to refinance and find a payment that they can afford, staying one step ahead. What this number doesn't show you are the number of people who are selling their house in distress sales. again, I go back to my neighborhood. I walk down that road, and on the sign next to the historical marker reminding me that it is a red line district are signs that say, facing foreclosure, call 1-800-something-something-something. We can help these families not only hold off foreclosure, but hold on to the equity in their home with some basic protections. I handed out a graph that shows you the typical payment shock of an exploding 228. I won't comment on that. I'll let you read that and ask questions if you haven't. I do want to speak to the Dash 11 and Dash 7 amendments, because these are the amendments that are going to not only help the family stay in their home, but help them hold on to that equity. The Dash 11 amendments, as you heard, would establish a limitation on prepayment penalties. The Dash 7 amendments would prohibit the loan flipping or turning a borrower into a loan that provides them no real economic benefit. And that's the type of protection that would have helped the woman that I mentioned from saving the equity in her home. I'll close now and take any questions that you might have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm going to suspend questions.
Can I just ask Mr. Monis a question? Because I don't think he's going to stay. I think he has to go back to North Carolina. Is that correct?
I do, yes.
Can I just ask a quick question, please, about the Dash 7s?
I will indulge you.
I'll be brief. The Dash 7 amendments that have to do with the flipping, you mentioned that the similar language is in effect in other states and that it seems to be working there, but does it lead to a lot of disputes or uncertainty about what that means in the language of that Dash 7 amendment?
Thank you for the question. In North Carolina, we actually have had the standard in place the longest, and we've done a survey of 5 years of court cases that relate to mortgage lending or home ownership. We did not find one single case that challenged a lender based on the anti-flipping provision, based on the tangible net benefit standard. Our experience, and we believe it's supported by the data, is that it provides an important signal to the marketplace. Lenders comply with it, and it has not led to any litigation that we know of.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, and Mr. Moss, I appreciate you coming from North Carolina to testify on this for our committee here in Oregon.
And thank you, colleagues, for hearing this bill. It's very important. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon.
Thank you, Representative Kotek. Next up, I'd like to call some folks that have traveled for more than 100 miles as designated by the sign-up sheet. Sure that you get this correct. I've got Melissa Stashen, Harriet Bing.
Oh, I'm sorry. I checked the wrong box. I didn't travel more than 100 miles.
You did not travel more than 100 miles. Okay. The other one, Mike Woods, I believe, is the name.
I'm sorry, I checked the wrong box on that one.
Oh, so I guess we're going to go back to the top of the list. I appreciate your honesty. There was your opportunity to jump in front.
Did anybody travel more than 100 miles?
Did anybody travel more than 100 miles?
Who wants to testify?
You didn't sign up?
Yeah, I signed up, but it's interesting, this whole group. I'm the only broker from Eastern Oregon here.
Come on up, sir.
Typically, there's
no applause for people from Eastern Oregon. No, not kidding.
That's all right.
I went to LeGrand High School, so.
I'm from Hermiston. My name is Keith Morgan. I'm an independent broker in Hermiston, and by all rights, I think I may be the only animal of that nature in the entire eastern half of the state. Everybody else is basically tied to a specific company or supported by a larger broker. I was not planning on saying anything today. But when I sat here and listened to the problems with adjustable rate mortgages, rates going up, I was just thinking of a deal that I just did for a police officer in Hermiston, who could have never bought a home 2 years ago if we wouldn't have had subprime loans. And the plan, it's like anything else. If you take advantage of that situation, it's a problem. If you use the tool to help the people, you're fine. And that's exactly what we did within that two-year period. Before his loan went to maturity and the rate went to 11 or 12%, we refinanced his house The house had appreciated in value. We gave him time to improve his credit. We were able to go on to an automated system that gave him an approval that allowed him to stay in his home and maintain his equity. I mean, there's abuses in every area that we move to. If we operate credibly, there's a place for the subprime loan. There's so many people. You know, you talk about the ethnic background. We live in a very high Hispanic marketplace. There are a number of people in the Hispanic marketplace that would not qualify for an A-paper loan. The reason I became a broker 8 years ago was that I was working for a bank, and when they walked through the door, we were kicking them out as fast as they were walking through the door because they weren't an A-paper deal. They didn't have 20% down. They weren't the people that the banks wanted to deal with. So I guess I'm here to say that from a practical standpoint, and I haven't had a chance. I just learned about this whole thing yesterday. I got blast emails from everybody in Portland because I don't know if you guys are aware of it, but the Cascade Mountains, Oregon stops, and then everything else over there. So I started getting blast emails from the Portland area of the problem that was existing here. And I thought, man, this is going to take a huge chunk out of my business and the 7 or 8 or 10 people that I have employed in Hermiston. So I wanted to hear what the problems were and how we were going to resolve this or how we were going to deal with the problems at hand, because it's a very deep concern to me for the people that I employ. They're not going to be able to go to work in Hermiston and make the kind of money that we're able to make. And again, I guess I go back to if you operate a credible business and you take care of the customer, there's not even a need for this bill. The other thing that concerns me is that when I sign a broker agreement with Countrywide, with Flagstar, with we've got 50 different lenders, I have to sign in that broker agreement that I will not flip loans, that I will treat the consumer with the respect that they deserve. The market, the subprime market, has taken care of itself for the most part. I mean, I'm making phone calls that are saying, look, we're no longer in business because they did bad loans. If we look at the marketplace and how the marketplace operates, the market will take care of itself in many, many instances. Subprime lenders have fallen. New Century, one of the largest subprime lenders in the United States, is not taking any new submissions. Millennium Funding, a company in Portland, I called to do a deal the other day. We are not taking any new submissions. The market is there to govern itself to a certain degree, and I understand there needs to be protection. But subprime lenders are falling off the face of the earth as fast as they're coming on. They are taking care of themselves because they did bad loans. The most important thing to me since I've been here is hearing the fact that this is going to govern everyone. Banks, credit unions, finance companies, mortgage brokers, and mortgage bankers. Because the playing field really isn't all that level. I've probably said more than I needed to.
Thank you very much for your perspective. And I know you all just love what he had to say, but it really isn't appropriate to applause after speakers get done. So if you could refrain yourself from that emotion, it would speed things up and allow some more people to testify. Not that I'm trying to be rude or anything. I'm not. I just would like to hear from people. So next up, I'd like to have Mary Hunt, Tom Hendrickson, and Eric Wiley. And again, if you're submitting written testimony, please don't read it to us. And if you could summarize, and I would like you to keep your comments down to 2 minutes if possible. So that we could hear more. We have a tremendous amount of people signed up, and we may not get through everybody. So if you can keep it going, we'll hear more people. Thank you. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Sorry, I applauded, by the way. My name is Mary Hunt. I'm a realtor with Oregon First in Gresham, Oregon. I'm not a lender. I'm a CRS. While that might not mean a lot to you, 8% of the realtors nationwide have this designation. I'm a broker, I'm an e-pro, and I'm an ABR, which is an accredited buyer's representative. I've been doing this for over 10 years. I come here today to oppose Senate Bill 965 as presented. I'm passionate about this bill. I've been a first-time home buyer specialist for over 10 years, and I specialize in this field because I want to help the consumer. Many first-time home buyers have a lot of challenges, and many realtors aren't willing to help them because, frankly, there's not that much money in it. There's a lot of challenges. Some of the challenges they face, it's hard to get someone to help them. They have credit issues. Homes cost more today than they used to. They can afford condos, but because there are renter-to-ratio rules that lenders follow, it's tough for them to get in those. So we have townhouses that they can afford, but we have the land use laws regarding density, which has made the homes tall and skinny. These folks are young couples or people that want to have families, and there's just no room to raise a family. They want a yard, you know, for their dog and their kids. So unfortunately, there's a few lower-range, price-ranged homes that are stick-built. Most of them are fixers, and a lot of times they can't get loans on those because the banks and the lenders are going to require an appraisal and inspections. So they're competing with the investor that plunks down cash 7-day close, and the first-time home buyer once again has lost a home. So they then if I do, you know, I do find them a home, I get them into a home, then they face the opposition there because they have now got their credit linked with insurance, and now it's tough for them. They have absurd huge insurance payments once they get into a home, which also kind of bases them out. So now comes along Senate Bill 965, and I just put this together last night because I just heard about it, and I'm just, you know, I'm sick about it because these folks don't fit into the bank's square box criteria. Many of my clients, which are first-time home buyers, would not have obtained a loan. Many of them I've helped into a second home. So it does help these folks. And according to an independent study by the National Association of Mortgage Brokers in 2005, the mortgage brokers originate 2 out of every 3 loans nationwide, and we need these innovative lenders' tools. Without them, we're going to add one more layer that makes it impossible for the first-time home buyer. We need the flexibility in the lending process. And I'd like to just put a face on the first-time home buyer. They're comprised mostly of lower-income folks that are renters, single mothers, young couples starting out. And a lot of these couples don't have parents that can help them, you know, with a down payment. And they really, you know, they're inner city, they're minorities, and they're rural market buyers. We need these folks to buy homes because these folks, by virtue of home ownership, are making neighborhoods better. They're not renting, they're going in and they're improving these neighborhoods. Please don't disable the lender, the broker's ability to structure loans to help the majority of these first-time home buyers. I'm in agreement with Ms. Martin on her statistics and that we do need protection for predatory lenders. I am in favor of that. But we need to have a balance here where we protect the first-time home buyer. And I'm urging you to revisit this bill by taking into consideration the impact it will have on the first-time home buyer and their future. The impact it will have on neighborhoods and on families. Please don't take away their first-time home buyer's opportunity to grab the brass ring for the small piece of the American dream. Please revisit this bill before sending it on and support the UFL amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm just going to make a comment here real quick. We do need to keep this moving so your comments can be kind of short. But, you know, I'm very sorry that there seems to be this hysteria that's been created over an email or something that's gone out from interest groups that have been involved. This bill was first heard on April 23rd. And, you know, it has passed out with all the lobby from all these associations and groups weighing in on it as it's been moving through the process. And this bill is not banning subprime loans, but they are looking at regulations. And just, you know, we are going to take a close look at this. We intend on not impacting the economy of Oregon by outlawing loans that are legitimate. So just my own little comment. Representative Riley is dying to say something.
I am. Thank you. I'm very sympathetic with this. But what I'd like to hear from the people who testify is, what specifically in this bill is going to cause you a problem? And what I'm hearing is, and forgive me, but what I hear is, this is going to hurt people. And I don't know why. And what I want to know is what in this bill specifically is going to cause the problem. That's what I'd like to hear.
Thank you, Representative Riley. If you could state your name for the record, please, and if you could try to keep it to 2 minutes, it would be helpful.
My name is Tom Hendrickson. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm a mortgage broker. I'm the current legislative chair of the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals and, incidentally, a past president of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association as well. I have concerns about the passage of SB 965 in its current form, though I'm sure everything is well-intentioned. When the bill started out, as already discussed by David Tapman, it involved implementing the guidelines of CSBS and ARMOR. I'm certainly in support of those guidelines. But when the language changed, when it went into the bill, I lost some support. And maybe the biggest concerns we've had is in discussions we've had with the people with DCBS and DFCS, who are good people, well committed to trying to protect the consumer in Oregon. But when we got into individual discussions of how the guidelines would be implemented, where we originally were talking about high-cost loans and predatory lending, and even the subprime markets been discussed, we've really moved away from that whole issue. The bill has changed. It's in its fifth version, and the version that we have now doesn't relate to those areas any longer. Instead, the potential now is that the bill could touch almost every residential loan in Oregon, which was certainly not the original intent. In its practice, the bill will be implemented through the re-underwriting of individual loans by DFCS employees while performing their periodic on-site audits of mortgage lenders' offices. In potential cases we've discussed, the review of underwriting could apply not only to those loans deemed non-traditional, like the interest-only loans, ARMs with negative amortization, option ARMs, and others, but also to traditional loans that are approved through the automated underwriting systems of the federal government and the government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Those underwriting systems have become the basis of underwriting the vast majority of all mortgage loans in the U.S. during the past decade. They've allowed more Americans to obtain home ownership and prevented the unlawful discrimination in underwriting due to their objective quantitative analysis of all underwriting factors. To turn the clock back on these gains that these systems have brought us would severely limit home ownership, preventing many consumers from moving from subprime loans into better products and lower the value of homes in Oregon due to the impact of allowing less borrowers to purchase homes even when their loans were approved or approvable by these government-sponsored systems. At the very least, the rates and prices Oregon consumers would pay would increase due to decreased competition. Those firms who now originate most Oregon mortgages, which includes mortgage brokers, mortgage bankers that are not owned by national banks, state chartered banks, and credit unions together, goes from the 65 to 67% we talked about up to over 75% of all mortgage loans in the states. Only the national banks, who, though they're included in the language of the bill, would de facto be exempted, I think most everyone would recognize through the Wachovia case, if not otherwise, would be allowed to continue to originate loans the way we all do them now, using the automated underwriting systems. Other lenders would feel a real threat, and some of the wholesale market that would work with the originators, the brokers who do those loans, may not choose to do business in Oregon or offer their products here anymore, if only in Oregon are they subject to fines and penalties for approving and purchasing the same mortgages that they're buying throughout the country. So the effect on Oregon property values would be bad. People who hit it most hard would be some of the rural areas, low-income and minority borrowers. These are people who are more served by these small community lenders, whether mortgage brokers or small community banks, than by the large banks. Bottom line is that the role of the DFCS auditor when they come into a lender's office should not be to underwrite mortgage loans. It shouldn't be to sit down and go to the underwriting decision on each individual loan and how, if there was something wrong with that, we want to penalize you because you made the wrong decision. If we use the automated underwriting systems the federal government has provided, then we should be able to make the loans according to those standards that are nationwide. What we need is more time to consider these issues, to evaluate those things. I'm asking for support of Senate Bill 965, Amendment A8. And that A8 amendment is further being amended, but you'll see that soon. A8 now is the amendment that says that the Legislative Assembly finds and declares that the guidance on non-traditional mortgage product risks dated 2006 and issued by the Conference of State Bank Supervisors and the American Association of Residential Mortgage Regulators contains important risk management. The Director of the Department of Consumer Business Services shall adopt rules that incorporate the recommended lender practices. And I won't read the rest of the amendment, but basically what it does is refer to the DCBS to go into the rulemaking process, which will give all stakeholders a chance to participate, have hearings, have public input, have a commentary period, work together with us to say, how are we going to solve this problem? We're no longer talking about a bill that relates to high-cost lending or predatory lending. We're talking about far-reaching things that could keep us from doing the regular loans that are being done throughout the country. So I appreciate your support on that. I want to clarify one other thing, too. And David Tatman's conversation, and we didn't, if this had come up in the conversations we had even earlier today, I would have clarified it then, but the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals is the primary trade association for mortgage, residential mortgage lenders, and particularly brokers throughout the state, has not asked for a change in the role of mortgage bankers as it would be defined under 965. That was something that apparently was done by a group of individuals acting in their own capacity, but that did not come from the trade association for the industry. I know that you probably don't have time for questions, so I thank you, Chairman Holby, and members of the committee for having the opportunity to speak to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hendrickson.
Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Eric Wiley. I'm co-owner and chief operating officer of Pacific Residential Mortgage operating in Lake Oswego, Oregon. We're also, I think, by volume, the second biggest independent mortgage brokerage in the state of Oregon. I'd like to second the fact that I was at a similar meeting with the Department of DCBS on Monday, and in no way did the mortgage broker community ask to also be included in the bill. I'd also like to say that, frankly, I think that the Senate Bill 965 in its present form is well-intentioned, but has very large unintentional consequences for Oregonians. I believe that inadvertently, particularly within Section 4 of Senate Bill 965, I believe indirectly that basically attacks homeownership in Oregon. The reason being, Senate Bill 965 demands subjectivity, it demands personal liability and personal accountability for underwriting standards and for ensuring repayment capacity of a borrower. And that is over and above national and regulated underwriting guidelines instituted nationally. If passed, Senate Bill 965 requires regulated lenders to second-guess industry-wide lending guidelines due to the fact that lenders are forced to ensure repayment capacity of each borrower. While it's a nice goal, it is, in practice, very difficult, if not impossible. Consumers that qualify for Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac loan programs, particularly national affordability loan programs, may not necessarily be able to obtain them from state-regulated lenders based upon additional stipulations and questions that arise in Senate Bill 965. This bill also brings the very high likelihood of conflict with Fair Lending and Equal Credit Opportunity Act laws. These are requirements that all mortgage lenders have placed upon them, whether a brokerage or a lender themselves. Because we cannot lend equally, but at the same time, under subjective requirements of repayment capacity, even when a consumer qualifies for financing per the national guidelines. This is a stipulation that would be very difficult and create subjectivity out of an objective process. Particularly also minorities and special group interests and the credit challenge, consumers have unequal credit histories, amounts of income, and monetary assets. Many federally backed lending programs allow for reduced qualifications for first-time homebuyers or special interest groups. Many of these same loan programs are significantly regulated in Senate Bill 965 to the point where they cannot effectively be provided to consumers through the state-regulated lender channels if Senate Bill 965 passes in its present form. I am also in support of the United Financial Lobby bill that would be Senate Bill 965A8, and as further amendments are made to that were discussed today with the department directly, I am in support of that. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Next up, I'd like to have Todd Williams, Christy Stevens, and Harriet Bing.
And I will apologize to those that I don't get to, because testimony seems to be taking longer than the 2 minutes. So,
is that a hint?
Yeah.
You can say that. Introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon. My name is Todd Williams. I'm past president of the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals. I've also been a member of their ethics committee since it was founded in 1996. I promise I have prepared marks on behalf of the association, some of which were covered by Mr. Hendrickson and Mr. Wiley. I promise I will not speak one word from those prepared remarks. I have basically 4 points that I want to get across to this committee and be very succinct about them. First of all, understand that the mortgage origination community, whether broker, banker, mortgage banker, or otherwise, is the solution, not the problem. We are out there trying to make good loans for good people. The best example I can give you of the major issue we're having with regard to predatory lending has to do with enforcement, not to do with the legislation itself. Legislation exists regarding the whopping majority of the loans that you hear about every day and the horror stories, several of which were brought up here. To give you an example of the lack of enforcement we have, I have been a licensee in this state since there was a license. 1994 was when mortgage licensing started. Since 1994, I have been audited once, and that was only because I was a member of the Ethics Committee. We thought it was a good idea that we have a self-inflicted audit since we were providing counsel to the division on complaints and the like. Audited once in 14 years. There are many firms that have been in business almost as long as ours that have never been audited once, not by the division, not by anybody. Some enforcement would be most helpful. Our department, our community came to this body 3 different times in the last 5 years and have requested and passed added legislation to help regulate what we do. Second key piece, understand that any law that is passed by this body is inherently unlevel. And the reason for that is all federally insured institutions, the Washington Mutuals and Wells Fargo's and B of A's of the world, are federally exempt from anything that we do here. So understand that any law that you put in place to deal with mortgage brokers, mortgage bankers, credit unions, etc., creates an immediately inherent playing field in and of itself because a large section of the industry is exempt. Also know that a good share of the predatory pieces that are part of this bill are already covered by federal legislation, predominantly the Home Ownership Equity Protection Act, or HOPA, which is regulated by both HUD and Truth in Lending, for which I'm sure Representative Bonamici is quite aware. Last piece. You ask about why all the excitement, Chairman Holvey, regarding this issue. I will take responsibility on behalf of the association as one of the key people that started what you see here behind me today. The key piece to that is that 4 weeks ago there was a key clause that was in this bill that limited this bill to high-cost home loans only. It talked about a points and fees test. By the way, it's the exact same points and fee test which is in the HOEPA law in the federal government. As soon as that piece was carved out in committee, you went from trying to regulate 1 or 2% of the most egregious loans in this state to every loan in this state, except for exempt FDIC-insured institutions. That is why you see what you see here today, and it happened in 3 weeks' time. That is the problem that existed. We would very much like to work with this committee and the lobbies and create a bill that works for both sides. This body of people that you see here are about providing good home loans for people and providing good laws and good enforcement to carve the bad actors out of this market that you hear the horror stories about every day. On behalf of this committee, I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. My contact information is involved in here. You do have prepared comments for us on the key pieces, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Chairman and Representatives. My name is Christy Stevens. I actually own a mortgage company, Cosmopolitan Funding Group, in Lake Oswego, Oregon.
I'll go away for a minute.
Oh, sorry. I am also currently the president for the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, and I serve on the Delegate Council for the United States for the National Association of Mortgage Brokers. Obviously, we have a great team here, so I'm not going to go into detail. I would just like to surmise that we do two out of every three mortgage loans out there. And if you really take away the power for us to be able to give the diversity of the loan products and put all the onus onto the FDIC-insured folks out there, you're going to have a mess. You're going to have a mess with credit. You're going to have a mess with service, probably declining property values. We've got a bigger problem. We've gone away from the consumer protection issues and you know, it's blown up. Now our consumers are in dire straits because the products we need to get them out of, we need these products that are automated products, most of them, to get them in a better situation. So I am here to support home ownership as well as everybody back here. And I just want to further state that we are in favor of the amendment from UFL that is coming. It's in the process. We'd like to work with you. And we realize that this bill is a bit of a minefield, and we believe it is the map to get us through that minefield. So we'd like your vote for that amendment coming forth. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Harriet Bing, and I am the owner-broker of Park Avenue Mortgage, which is a very small little brokerage firm in Portland. And I'm here to testify not in favor of the bill as it presently stands. And I was in favor of the earlier version, which was talking about high points and that kind of thing, and this is completely different. I would also like to say that one of the reasons I'm sitting in this chair is because about 12 years ago, I was a victim of a very, very predatory loan. I was not in the mortgage business at that time. It's because of that loan that I ended up in the mortgage business. So I'm very sympathetic to Senator Carter's concerns, but I have read this bill as it stands now over and over again, and they do not in any way address what she was concerned about, which is racial profiling and discrimination and protecting the vulnerable from predators. Where your bill, or the bill as it's written, is talking about product, and product is not the issue. The issue is the people that present this product. In Oregon, in January of this year, the bar was raised for mortgage originators, which was a really good thing. That's kind of the place where you need to look. But even if you have all kinds of regulations, if you have people who choose to be bad actors, they're going to be bad actors no matter what the law says, and they need to be ferreted out. Also, I would like to say that I feel like in some respects everybody is believing Chicken Little that the sky is falling, and I think that national statistics actually argue against this. Foreclosures of all types rose to 1% in 2006. That means that 99% are not foreclosures. Black and Hispanic home ownership rates are near 50% now, hovering around all-time highs. This is according to HUD, their fourth quarter market conditions report published in February of this year. Even with the slowdown in the housing market and foreclosures in certain areas, home ownership for minorities are near all-time high. Solid economic growth is occurring. Inflation is under check, even with the increase in gas prices, et cetera, and unemployment rates. And that brings me back to something that one of the earlier speakers mentioned, three states, Minnesota, Colorado, and Ohio. One of the reasons Colorado has had the very, very distressing level of foreclosures is because until January 1st of this year, there was no licensing for mortgage originators in the state of Colorado, and anybody who wanted to was writing any kind of a loan they wanted. As at the same time, there were some real problems with unemployment rates going up there, and so the regulation, if it had been earlier and against and regulating the people who did the origination, you would not have seen some of the really bad loans that were written in Colorado. Ohio, the problem is very, very much to do with the fact that they are economically in a huge spiral. They're just absolutely spiraling the drain in terms of unemployment and that kind of thing. Those are different places with different problems. You'll see the problems in Colorado come to a grinding halt because they're now starting to regulate who can originate loans. It can't just be some guy next door who says, hey, I'm going to go get you a loan, and not knowing what the heck they're talking about. So I really think that this bill, the intent of which is fantastic to protect consumers, you're aiming your cannon in the wrong direction. The bill doesn't address the issues. Got just a few more comments to make here.
If you could make them quickly, please, so I can get that would be great. Thank you.
Okay, so
subprime lending is not the problem. It is not companies preying on disenfranchised individuals. It opens up the opportunity of home ownership to people who otherwise could not get it. The young woman who sat over here and said she walked around to her neighborhood and talked about the woman who became ill and who got 75% loan to value on her home, probably if she was going to not use a subprime lender, would have gotten nothing. She would not have been able to utilize the equity in her home without selling it, is my guess. The fact, I understand the concept of equity stripping, and that is a problem. You can deal with that by limiting points and possibly outlawing prepayment penalties. I can see them as being very, very unfair. But that has nothing to do with the products that we're talking about. Nothing. The gentleman who sat in this chair and talked about 228s, there are so many different 228 products out there, you can't even count them. There's probably 500 of them. They're all different. They all have nuances. It's how the products are used and how the people who are dealing with the consumer use them. I would support consumer education under certain loan products. People talk about negative amortization pay option ARMs as being some kind of evil thing. They have been in existence for over 22 years and have helped countless numbers of people become homeowners and protect their equity. If they are handled properly, they're actually an extremely good product. You know, the fact is the product and the automated underwriting systems are very neutral things. It's the people who give them and the consumers who take them that are the issue. I think some of this has to be put on the consumers themselves. Where is the responsibility to watch out for yourself in all of this? You know, consumer education might help. You see ads all over the place. There's a company whose name rhymes with LIHTC that talks about getting people into 4% or 3% loans or buying a $500,000 house with a $565 a month payment. Look at that, is false advertising. There is no small print in that ad. But if you looked at the small print and if a consumer paid any attention to what they were getting into, they would know how to make their choices. A couple more things, and I promise to stop. Okay.
I do too.
This is the last thing I would like to say. According to the Mortgage Bankers Association, delinquencies on mortgages of all types rose to 4.95% in the last quarter of 2006. This is lower than the delinquency rates in 2002, 2001, 1991, 1998, and the ones that have been recent were very, very close. The delinquency rates are actually not up that much. They are still caused by the same things that have always caused them, life events such as job loss, illness, divorce, or some other unexpected challenge. It's not about these products. I think you're aiming your cannon in the wrong direction. That's all I have to say.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Kathy Landis, Bill Carnahan, and Christian Cotter.
While they're coming up, I'd like to welcome Representative Cameron to our committee.
Hey. Oh, didn't even see him down there.
He snuck in.
Through the window.
Okay, if those three aren't coming up, I'm going to call the next three.
20% of the quarter.
So Catherine Lance, Bill Carnahan, and Christian Cotter aren't here. We'll move on to... Oh, you're not coming to speak? Oh, thank you. Judy Wood, not that I wouldn't like listening to you. Judy Woods, Bill Ridge, and George Thompson. And I apologize for the short time for those of you who aren't going to get a chance. I would guess that.
I would guess that's right.
Thank you. If you could state your name for the record, please.
George Thompson. I'm a little different because I'm not a mortgage broker, but I am a loan officer. And I do that by choosing, by the way. But my address is to Representative Riley because you asked some very good points as to what we're concerned about this bill. The principal concerns I have are sections 12 and 13, which the penalties imposed upon, in my case, the individual loan officers. These are personal liability issues. Who's to say that 1 or 2 years after the loan is made, a disgruntled homeowner with perfect 20/20 hindsight goes to an attorney and sues me? That's a big issue with me. Because this is not just the problem with suing my company. It's suing me personally.
Thank you.
That's my concern.
Thank you for that. And it's not the first time I've heard that one. I appreciate you getting that one on the record. Go ahead and state your name.
Good afternoon. My name is Judy Woods, and I have been in the industry for 25 years, and I'm a senior loan consultant for Eli Financial. The reason I'm here is because I'm very concerned about Senate Bill 965 and the effect it would have on borrowers and the Oregon economy. It's completely lacking in competent understanding and the means to achieve the intended goals. What I wanted to focus on was several negative implications which will result from legislation being passed, including reduced housing prices. It would reduce the volume of industry activity sufficient to cause a decline in the market value of homes due to the lack of demand. The bill states that the mortgages would be qualified, that the non-traditional mortgages would be qualified at the fully indexed rate and calculated at the remaining amortization period. This way of qualifying borrowers will eliminate a large number of very qualified borrowers to be able to enjoy the dream of home ownership. They would be forced to continue renting, of course. Representative Riley had asked some specifics on, you know, how this bill would affect different things. Short-term fixed mortgages help consumers in the following way. A couple of examples: the borrowers only plan to stay in the home for 3 to 5 years. The borrowers have increased income assured in the last 3 to 5 years. Investors and refinances would be greatly impacted. Without multiple products available, the lending industry will shrink and reduce competition, which will result in higher interest rates for conforming products, which normally offer attractive rates. The availability would be reduced for mortgage credit. You allow the bill to limit lender programs, the lenders will be put out of business, and the consumer will have limited choices and be forced to work with big banks and the big banks' limited options. Senator Brad Vakian, who I met with personally yesterday, stated the bill was based using language like should consider, stricter due diligence in qualifying borrowers. The bill says shall, which legally means must. The intent of supporting this bill was undoubtedly good, to protect the consumer. Unfortunately, it does more harm than good for the home buyers in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. And, sir, if you would like to wrap this up for us, state your name for the record.
Yes, sir. Bill Ridge, Portland, Oregon. I'm a salesman, loan officer. Just a couple of issues. I want to make sure that the committee and the people that are pushing forth the bill, there is a clear distinction between a foreclosure and a delinquency. We all need to understand that's a big, big difference. 10 years ago, the foreclosure rates were higher than they were now. So the question I want to put out there to people is that what is causing the foreclosure rates, or what are causing the delinquency rates today compared to years ago? I've done a lot of research. I had my research staff take a look at this. And these are just a couple tidbits of facts that I think you should really take a look at in coming up with a final bill on this thing here. The first fact I'm going to give you came from a Fannie Mae fourth quarter study picked up by USA Today.com. A gal by the name of Kathy Chu came to a conclusion from the Fannie Mae study that the average credit card debt in America is about $8,000 to $10,000. A few years ago, the credit card companies increased minimum payments from 2% to 4%. If you take an $8,000 to $10,000 credit card debt, on 2%, it was $160. If you increase it to 4%, that went to $320. In addition, the price of gas has caused the average homeowner to spend another $128 to $130 a month on consumer goods not related to mortgages. If you take a 20 or 30% increase in a mortgage rate, say from 5 or 6%, you put 20 or 30% increase in the adjusted rate, that has an impact of $250 on the mortgage. So the consumer, the single mom, the young family coming up, has got to make a choice. Do I drive to work and go to work to feed my family, or do I make the mortgage payment? I've been told they're going to go to work and forget the mortgage payment. They've got to eat. So it's not just because the interest rates have gone up. There are a lot of other issues that have gone on in here that have caused the problems we're in today. Another fact. This country, the Western world has seen an unprecedented growth in home values. I have, everybody has. And what has happened over the last 4 to 5 years, there has been a run on refinancing properties, taking the equity out of the properties into buying lavish consumer goods, only to find one day when somebody wakes up, the game is over. We're not having the 20 to 30% rates of appreciation. Now, these people are stuck with these mortgages that they can't afford.
Thank you. Are you finished?
Yes, sir.
I really appreciate your comments. I appreciate everybody coming forward with their heartfelt concern about this bill. It's not going unrecognized. We're going to continue to try to solve this issue. And with that, I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 965A. And I will be carrying over Senate Bill 484A, Senate Bill 684A, Senate Bill 965A to Wednesday, May 30th at 1 p.m. With that, I'm closing the House Committee on Consumer Protection.